turning to Exodus chapter 1. So we started our series through the book of Exodus. So this is now message number 2, entitled Never for Nothing. And we'll be looking at verse 8 through 22. So we're looking at the rest of chapter 1 here, but I do want to read verses 8 to 10 to get started. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. So why do we suffer? It's one of mankind's oldest and most difficult questions. Why is this happening? Why is this happening now? Why is this happening to me? And on one level, we can answer those questions with that word, sin. I mean, we know that ultimately suffering exists, and suffering is in the world because of sin. And sometimes our suffering is the direct consequence of our sinful actions, but oftentimes it's not quite that simple. We can't point to one thing and say, you did this, and so now you're suffering that. It's just not that simple, and we have a whole book devoted to that, the book of Job. Well, in the summer of 1967, there was a 17-year-old girl, Joni Erickson. She was having a good time that summer, had a good life, had bright hope for the future. She was spending a warm summer day swimming at a lake with her sister, and she dove headfirst into very shallow water. She hit her head on the bottom. She broke her neck. She surfaced and floated face down in the water, unable to move. So she would have died that day, but her sister saw her and pulled her up out of the water. And from that day until now, she's been a quadriplegic in a wheelchair. The first few years, by her own testimony, were very, very rough. She faced severe depression, and she questioned the value of her life. She was paralyzed in a wheelchair and in rehab, trying to learn how to paint pictures by holding a paintbrush with her teeth. What is the value of a life like this? What's the use of a life like this? What was the point of even being alive? Those were the things that she wrestled with. But Joni is a woman of very strong faith. She went on to become an advocate for people with disabilities, has helped countless numbers of people physically and emotionally and mentally and even spiritually with her work and her testimony. Joni believes very strongly in the sovereignty of God. She's 74 years old, and she explains her life this way. God's purpose behind my diving accident is now clear to me. He took a reckless, foolish teenager who thought her life was over and convinced her of the all-surpassing power and hope found only in Christ. He's using that story to inspire and encourage millions of readers and thousands of people with disabilities around the world, all so that they might be convinced of Christ's hope. That alone is worth decades of life in a wheelchair. Well, the story of Israel is a story of suffering. And what we begin to read here in the rest of Exodus chapter 1 is a story of suffering. Now, oftentimes in Israel's history, Suffering is explicitly explained to them as being the result of their own sins, of their own unbelief, of their own rebellion. But that is not the case in the sufferings in Egypt that we began to read about here in chapter 1. These sufferings are repeatedly referred to throughout the rest of the Bible, and they are given as a foundational aspect in their expected treatment of others. This is the words of Moses, Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 17 to 22. Thou shalt not pervert the judgment of the stranger or the foreigner, nor of the fatherless, nor take a widow's raiment to pledge. But thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in Egypt, and the Lord thy God redeemed thee thence. Therefore I command thee to do this thing. When thou cuttest down thine harvest in thy field, and hast forgot a sheaf in the field, thou shalt not go again to fetch it. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all the work of thine hands. When thou beatest thine olive tree, thou shalt not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. When thou gatherest grapes of thy vineyard, thou shalt not glean it afterward. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in the land of Egypt. Therefore I command thee to do this thing. And one of the great purposes in sufferings that we learn throughout the Bible, as well as here in the Pentateuch, is that we might sympathize with the suffering of others, never seeking to add to it, but to alleviate it in any way that we can. Well, this chapter shows us various purposes that are at work in the world, and those purposes are mostly contrary to God's purpose, and that results in great suffering. Well, verses 1 to 7 open the book of Exodus with an internal introduction to this book and a transition from the book of Genesis into the events of Exodus. Genesis closed with Israel in Egypt, and they were in prosperous conditions. They were doing well. They were treated well, received well. For quite a time, Egypt was actually very hospitable to the family of Joseph that had come down from the land of Canaan. Moses began this book with a list of Jacob's sons and the number of their families at 70 people that went into Egypt. Now, of course, such a list mirrors the genealogies that we encountered many times in the book of Genesis, but it's more of a list than a genealogy, and also the number is significant in the sense that it echoes that table of 70 nations that we have after the flood in Genesis as well. Well, the presence of Israel in Egypt and their multiplication, their growth, their abundance as a people were fulfillments of God's promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These were not just coincidence or just happenstance. These were the fulfillments of God's promises and His blessings on them as a people. Not for their sakes, but for the sake of His own name, for the sake of His own word that He spoke and swore to their fathers. And of course, this continued even after all the people who came into Egypt originally were gone. Well, the rest of chapter 1 describes how that Israel then went into slavery in Egypt and was oppressed and afflicted. And Moses highlighted here the contrast between the new Pharaoh and God's purpose. God's blessing of Israel in faithfulness to His promises to the patriarchs is interpreted radically differently by the new king. And he enacts three different policies opposing God's work, though he didn't know it as God's work. He was simply pursuing his own pleasures, his own lusts, his own desires, the things that made sense in his own mind. By the end of the chapter, the policies have not succeeded and have seemed to backfire. But nothing is resolved, and it's certainly not the end of the story. It's just beginning. So we'll look at this in two parts. In verses 8 to 14, we have an account of Israel going into slavery. And then in verses 15 to 22, we see the efforts of the Pharaoh to eradicate Israel and even to the command of a genocide. Let's start with verses 8 to 11. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph, and he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. Now the language that is used here, beginning here in verse 8, that of this new king, this new Pharaoh that arose in Egypt, the language here actually indicates a new dynasty. There's a change in power that takes place in Egypt, the ruling family that came to power. And it seems like that this new dynasty represented a return to native rule in Egypt. Remember, we had talked about those shepherd kings that had come and had moved west into lower Egypt and had began to rule after a time. And it seems that that time has ended. And there's a new dynasty, a new rule that has arisen in Egypt, this native rule, which would also help explain why there was such a distrust of foreigners, and especially foreign shepherds, as Israel were. That it says he didn't know Joseph doesn't mean that he didn't know him personally, but more that being a new dynasty, a new family of rule in Egypt, meant that he didn't acknowledge any obligation to Joseph or Joseph's people that come from the former rule. He didn't. That former dynasty, that was gone. He didn't recognize any responsibility there. And he describes Israel in verse number 9 actually as a people, that Hebrew word am. And we've talked about that various times in our studies. It's a word for nation or tribes. It's a word that highlights that ethnic cultural kinship among a people group. And so they're Israel is first really called a people group here in this particular passage, which speaks to how much that they have grown and multiplied, and how much they have developed in the land of Goshen beyond just Jacob and 70 members of his family that came into Egypt. So the new king suggests this plan. He wants to be shrewd in the way that they handle the problem of Israel, as it were. They want to curb and they want to subdue this people. Now, back up in verse number 7, we have a reflection there on the fact of God's blessing on Israel and this fulfillment of promises made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob concerning an innumerable seed nation that would come from them. But here we get this contrast that is presented, which actually, really when you think about the book of Exodus, much of it is spent in this contrast between good and evil, in a sense. But this blessing that you read about in verse number 7, that fulfillment of promises, the new king of Egypt didn't see it that way. He didn't see it that way at all. Rather, what he saw was a threat to Egypt's national sovereignty. They had already endured a dynastic rule from foreign invaders, so to speak. And were they going to fall to such a thing again? So Israel was a problem. And his first plan that's detailed here is enacted by enslaving the people of Israel. Now, Moses uses terms to describe the slavery and the work and such that they were engaged in. And all these terms that he uses, they're quite related, but they all emphasize the idea of involuntary servitude and great difficulty of the work that they were engaged in, the very hard labor that they were engaged in. And these cities that are mentioned, this Pithom and Ramses there at the end of verse number 11, these city sites, and there's various opinions about the location of those cities and opinions that are much more informed about that than I am, but there's some different sites that have been identified. But the stark contrast here is how that the great number of Israel is viewed by the Pharaoh. He looks upon this great population of this people group within Egypt. He looks upon them as a resource for the glory of Egypt and for the glory of his reign. He didn't know the extraordinary testimony to God's faithfulness that's unfolding right before his very eyes. He saw a threat, and he also saw a possibility. Surely, overburdening this people would slow down their extraordinary reproductive productivity. Let's look at verses 12 to 14. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. So the opposite of what the Pharaoh intended is actually what happened. And the language that's used here, particularly in verse number 12, even suggests that there was some amount of proportionality between the burdening of Israel and the greater burden that they put on them and the greater that they seem to multiply and to grow. The language of fruitfulness and multiplication obviously echoes from the very early pages of Genesis and the story of creation, and then again after the flood in regards to populating the earth. They do echo from there, but the be fruitful and multiply was not some binding or lasting command to all people of all time. And what's remarkable here is that God later promised to Abraham, whom he chose, to multiply him, Isaac, and Jacob. He didn't command them to multiply, but he promised that he would multiply them. The point was that their multiplication and their growth, it was extraordinary. It was more than normal. It was more than you might expect. But the point of it is that it was a blessing that God bestowed on them through his covenant and fulfilled his purpose to create a new nation. He was going to create this nation from Abraham, through whom he would bless all nations of the earth and fulfill his purpose of redemption of the world. In other words, it's important that we understand this reproduction of Israel and their growth and their abundance. It was unusual, and it was unusual because it is God specifically at work in response to his promises that he had made. Now, we're told here that all of this, of course, further aggravated or grieved the Egyptians, and the word that's used here has the idea really both of fear and of loathing, that the Egyptians and their view toward those of Israel actually was made even worse after they've enslaved them. They're making their bondage and their labor more burdensome, more troublesome, more difficult, and all the while they continue to grow at a very abundant and fast rate. And so it made the Egyptians essentially hate them all the more. They were afraid of Israel, and they also despised them. Well, they responded to this, as we read in verse 14, they responded to this by increasing the bitterness of their slavery. the more that they saw their efforts not working, the more that they tried to make them work. And there's terms here again in verse 14 in particular that are just multiplied, that emphasize the involuntary service, the difficulty of the work, and the suffering and hardship. And we're told that they were making bricks, obviously, in the region of Egypt where stone was not readily available, and they would have been mixing and you know, baking these bricks and things to be used in building. They're obviously using them as they built the cities that are mentioned previously. So their response is only to make things more and more and more difficult on Israel. Well, then that brings us to the second part of this chapter, really, verses 15 to 22, where finally the Pharaoh has to resort to genocide. Verse 15 and 16. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of one was Shiphrah, the name of the other Puah. And he said, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then you shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. So now we're given Pharaoh's second of his three plans in this first chapter. And his second plan, after that he has enslaved the people and that has not achieved the objective that he had, he has given a command to the midwives to kill the male babies as they were born to the Hebrew women. And we see that word used a few times. That the word for Hebrew here essentially means from beyond, from maybe even like from across the river or something like that. But it's a term that came to be applied to Israel. It's also a word that seemed to be mostly used in the mouths of other nations and probably had a derogatory meaning along with it. And so they were ordered to kill these, if it be a boy, if it be a male baby, that they were to kill it in the birth. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God and did not, as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. So Moses makes a note here that the midwives didn't obey what Pharaoh had commanded them to do. They didn't kill any of the male babies, but they saved them. Now, what is interesting about this is that they weren't reacting to any specific promise. They weren't reacting to any specific command from God. These midwives did not witness some miraculous sign, but Moses says they did it because they feared God. Now, that phrase typically indicates those who are believers. And Moses is saying that these women were women of faith. And because of that, they did not carry out the Pharaoh's command. They had respect to God's word. Though what they had of it would have been oral tradition preserved among Israel to that point. They would have known of things like the story of Cain and Abel. They would have known of the covenant with Noah. And all of these, of course, reveal the sinfulness of murder. And that's what they had been commanded to do. But because they feared God, they would not do it. And in fact, didn't do it. So on the one hand, we don't know much about them. But Moses does name them and says twice that they feared God. So the way that he records this, he lets us know that these actions were actions of faith. That was the motivation. That was the reason why they did what they did. Verses 18 and 19. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, why have you done this thing and have saved the men children alive? And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. So now Pharaoh's second plan has failed. failed in a different way, I suppose. He commanded all of his taskmasters, and they responded and they obeyed his commands to make the slavery of Israel as bitter as possible. But now at this time, they've not obeyed his commands. These midwives have not obeyed. And so the explanation that they give as they are called in before him to give an account, this explanation seems a bit thin, to be honest. But we're not really told of any repercussions against them. He doesn't seem to take any action against them, even though, again, probably not the best explanation, which seems to indicate that this was probably more of a secretive, under-the-table kind of arrangement. This was probably a little more off the record that he took these two specific midwives and gave them this command. Later he's questioning them why they didn't do it. They give him this explanation, which, you know, doesn't really seem fully sufficient, but nevertheless, they don't really have any repercussions because of it. Now, we may have questions about this, but we're really not given anything more. And what Moses did record, both in their motivation and in the outcome, he puts it in the language of a story of faith. Because they feared God, they did not obey the Pharaoh, they had respect to God's word, they saved the children alive, and in the end, God blesses them. God rewards them for their faithfulness. And we're just not given any more. Verse 20, therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. So the result of Pharaoh's second plan now was once again the same, the multiplication of the people of Israel. Now, this continues to be emphasized in this first chapter, and even though the Pharaoh is taking actions, he's making plans to deliberately curtail this, but is unsuccessful and only seems to make it worse from his perspective. Well, this indicates to us that this abundance, once again, it wasn't just some coincidence. It wasn't just some sort of circumstance. It was the abundance, the result of God's blessing. And it was not also the result of some subversive plan on the part of the Jews. In other words, as we read this account, the Jewish people are actually quite passive. And things are just happening to them. They're not opposing Pharaoh. They're not resisting Pharaoh. They're not trying to organize and marshal themselves together for some sort of an uprising. They're not taking some sort of secretive plan. Well, let's try to have, you know, even more babies than what we're already having, and we'll show him. No, not anything of the kind is going on. The way that Moses has told us this story is for us to understand that this is God's blessing. This is God's evident blessing on them. And we can trace the roots of it. When we go back into the book of Genesis and go back to Abraham and Isaac and to Jacob, and we can see those promises given and reiterated and repeated and confirmed that he is going to multiply this seed into a great and mighty and numerous nation. And that's actually what he's doing. Not only did he promise this, but he even promised specifically to Jacob that while they were in Egypt, he was going to multiply them greatly. So again, this Pharaoh is making plans to try to curtail what is taking place. Israel's not fighting back. They're just simply experiencing the blessings of God because of the promise that he made to their fathers. Well, the midwives were told they were specifically blessed. And they were specifically blessed because of their faith, because that they feared God. It's said that God made them houses. And what this means is he essentially blessed them with large families of their own. Moses reiterated that they feared God. And that's what informed and motivated their actions in defiance of Pharaoh. Verse 22, and Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. So now Pharaoh reveals his third plan, as his first two have failed. This is how he plans to combat the problem of Israel. It's sort of his own final solution, probably the first final solution that was proposed for the Jews. So he commands his people of Egypt to commit genocide, throwing all of the male babies of the Jews into the Nile River. Now, there's not any indication that this was carried out, but it sets up, obviously, the great event in the next chapter, this command of the Pharaoh. And of course, having read this story and seen a certain pattern that has emerged in it, we can certainly expect this is not to be successful either. One of the things I love about this chapter is how that it's so sweeping and it's so grand. One of the things I talked about in the previous sermon was how that the book of Exodus, it begins, it covers, 300 years or so. Then the next chapter covers about 80 years or so. And then all the rest of the book is in about a year's time. So what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that it's pretty fast-paced and sort of starts to slow down. The second half of the book of Exodus is quite slow compared to what we have in the first. But think about what all's taking place in his first chapter, just how grand and sweeping that it is. We have a new dynasty rising to power in what would have been considered a first world nation in that time, one of the world powers, the nation of Egypt. We have the growth of an infant nation in Israel. We have aspects of governmental policy, issues of domestic relations and immigration and labor and national security, all these great sweeping things taking place. And then we get toward the end of the chapter, and we have two women, two Hebrew midwives. Now, being Hebrew midwives in Egypt, serving an enslaved people, was not a glamorous and highly esteemed position. And there's even some suggestion in the language, and we go back to that shaky sort of explanation that they give to Pharaoh. There's even some suggestion in the language that they use that they are referring to the Hebrew women as giving birth more like wild, undomesticated animals who simply, drop their young and go on about the day. And this may have reflected, it may have been a little tongue-in-cheek, I suppose the phrase would be, the Egyptian attitude toward the foreigners that they had enslaved, as they detested them and really viewed them as somewhat subhuman. And so that may have been a little bit of a biting reproof to the Pharaoh and his views. But midwifery, and that's just a word I've always found to be a strange word and would have never pronounced it that way had I not actually known some midwives and them correct me on the phrase. But midwifery was a menial task, a very low social standing. But these two women, in the midst of all these grand sweeping things taking place, are actually exalted in this narrative by the time that we get to the end, and they're blessed by God. Now, we don't know the extents of their sufferings in the scheme of the grand story, but we are twice told about their faith. These women did not speak with a burning bush. These women didn't see fire and smoke and hear the thunderous voice of God from the mountain. They did not witness water being turned into blood, nor did they see staffs on the ground slithering as serpents. They didn't have any specific promise or any specific command from God for their very particular circumstance, which was just the mundane chores of life. That was their occupation. But what we do have, and what they had, is that they feared God, and they acted out of that faith. So faith and suffering are never for nothing, especially when they are joined together. Of course, I stole some of that title from a book by Elizabeth Elliot. Suffering is never for nothing. And she was a woman who certainly knew something about that as well. Israel wasn't trying to do anything in this situation. They're living, they're trying to get through the day, and then the next day, and then the next day. And despite all that they suffered, they continued to be blessed out of measure because of God's faithfulness to His own word that He'd sworn to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Pharaoh wasn't deliberately trying to defy the God of the universe. Pharaoh didn't even know who God was. He didn't wake up every morning thinking, I'm going to get God today. He didn't know who God was. What Pharaoh was doing, though, was serving the own sinful thoughts of his own sinful heart and mind. And he was seeking his own glory and that of the nation that he ruled. And to his glory, the Jews were a problem and they were a threat. And he set about to solve that problem. Well, these are the kinds of lessons that we really need today. These are what we might call nutrition blocks that feed and nourish faith. There are things going on around us all the time that we know nothing about, that we can do nothing about, and some things that we know probably make us scared and uneasy and bring various aspects of suffering on us. So men and women today, just as then, pursue their own purposes, and those purposes that oppose God. And that facilitates a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, a lot of misery in this world. Well, we are able to read Israel's story in the Bible with knowledge of what God has revealed about His purpose. And His faithfulness assures us all His promises will be fulfilled. And that, of course, means salvation and eternal life for all who believe. And we're going to find out in the next chapter that the suffering and the cries of His people don't fall on deaf ears with God. He is very much concerned with it. Thank you.